Well, old Mr. Johnson had troubles all his own. He had an old yeller cat that wouldn't leave home. Tried everything he knew to get the cat to stay away. Even took him up to Canada and told him for to stay. But the cat came back the very next day. Thought he was a goner, but the cat came back, 'cause he wouldn't stay away. Then they took him to the shop where the meat was ground, and they dropped him in the hopper when the butcher wasn't round. Well, the cat disappeared with a blood-curdling shriek, and the town's meat tasted furry for a week. But the cat came back the very next day. They thought he was a goner, but the cat came back, 'cause he wouldn't stay away.
Estrepus 4. I slept until after breakfast, and missed lunch, too. Well, the two of them was already up and about. Their suitcases was packed. We was lumbering along turbulence and shelves of tumbled rock in the Potomac River I saw out my window when I raised the shade. Autumn here is not yet come. It's still a summery green outside. I heard the conductor passing in the corridors calling out for Harper's Ferry. "Last stop," he cried. Last before Washington, and I did not know what that meant for me or how much time I had, so I got dressed in a hurry and packed, too. My suit was swell. I'd never had such a tailored suit, and the hat was good enough for Humphrey Bogart, I should think. And I felt like some underworld hero to rank that hat down and scowl up under its slouched brim. I did not think May Bell would know me to look at me as I looked at myself in the full-length mirror back of the bathroom door. Haywire and Billy was not in the dining room, and the service had stopped. I understood that poor third cook would be racing to get done before they got to the station. I peeked in at him as I went back and wanted to say something, but I knew he would think it strange, so I left it. And I found the two of them tucked into those posh chairs at the back of the lounge car with highballs. And while the Negro was hoping to get everything put away, tote his tab and count his stores so he could get off and go home as soon as he got there, he was truly content to take an order for refills from them and one for me. And of course the 20 handed in tribute. He had made more off Haywire this trip than he'd get in a paycheck, I guessed. He would call him Uncle if he wanted. Now, the thing about niggers is that they call all the old men that they respect Uncle. And they call each of their fellow men brothers and call women sisters, because as Sam explained to me once, they had no way of knowing in the old days, when they was slaves, who was related to who anyhow. And besides, he said, "You need all the kin you can get." It was an affection among them I was glad to have a part of it, since my own papa was harsh and a hard-drinking man. Not like Haywire's, maybe in the drinking part, but just as cold as death as his papa was. Thinking this made Haywire look different in the light of day. And I wondered, looking at Billy, if he knew these things. Billy went his own way when we detrained. Haywire did not explain, but I assumed I would see him later. Anyway, we got a cab, just us two, outside the Union Station, on a traffic circle with a splashy fountain in the center of it. I had never seen a traffic circle, and could not guess how cars kept from hitting one another, or how drivers knew their right-of-ways. The U.S. Capitol dome was in sight, on its hill, alone, and magnificent, and we wheeled past the front of it, headed down Pennsylvania Avenue, and came on the White House. And it was a strange feeling, seeing all these things you've seen in photos all your life, and seen talked about in newspapers and in books. And I could almost see real scenes of history around them as we passed. They were much more handsome than I had expected somehow, and it gave me an elevated feeling, and a feeling of my own importance, seeing them. And being in that new suit, I felt like I belonged to how great they was, somehow. I guess I felt proud to be an American. I guess that that is what it was. Turning in front of the White House, the cab took a boulevard to the Mayflower Hotel. When I got out, the first thought I had, this city smells like money. And here, just like at the Palmer House, everyone knew Haywire. And again, everything was arranged. He was expected. And he swept through the lobby like it was his own house. But I gotta tell you, Maybelle, you ain't never seen nothing like this. First, you see him, how he looked, especially as other people who maybe did not know him seen him. Well, I guess you know, he dressed like a cowboy like he does, but impeccably. Ain't no shit on his boots, for sure. And his rosewood guitar, with the pearl and ebony inlay about the whole of it, swung around behind him, his fine silvery felt cowboy hat tipped way back on his head, the way maybe you remember, what's his name? Will Rogers used to do it. To show his honest face openly and gladly, and grinning like he done, too. Regular folk, and a true good man. You felt it always to see him. And nothing he ever told me, nor I ever learned about him, will never change my mind and how I love him. But he was an unlikely sight in that glorious lobby. If you put a pauper on a throne, if you put me in the movies, if you made our preacher the Pope, you could not make a more awkward sight. And yet, he was in perfect comfort for all of it. I did believe then everything he had told me about himself. He must be a very rich man, true. All the clerks and uniform staff and the hotel manager in a morning coat with tails all swarmed him and were not just courteous. They were really glad to see him and rattled off all the arrangements that they have presumed to make for him, and he expressed back to them his real gratitude, warmly, and a kind of shucks, gosh, thanks kind of humility like Gary Cooper might. And the lobby of this place is like as big as an auditorium, and so high in the ceiling I seen there was a balcony going around 3/4 of it, and a whole nother floor up there where people were sitting, dining for lunch at small tables served by niggers in tuxedos with linen napkins draped over their forearms like you seen in the movies or heard about. Beaux-art garlands and festoons of carved plaster on the ceiling, and the ornate Corinthian capitals of marble columns holding that lofted ceiling in orderly spans were all glittering with thick gold leaf. Haywire later told me there was more gold leaf in this lobby than in all the government buildings and all the museums in Washington combined. The space was like jewelry. The floor is polished marble, sweeping to a marble staircase at a distance before us. Persian carpets large as our whole house are laid out, making plush paisley islands to walk upon, and there were 6 of them placed in 2 long rows between rows of gold-capped columns in a line from the gilded porch entry to the wide staircase at the back of that palatial lobby. There, a grand marble staircase with balustrades of the same marble, as if seamlessly carved from one oceanic slab of marble, swept up in scallops of curvaceous stairs and tiers of wide landings, up to the narrowing at the top, where the mezzanine restaurant was to be entered, where a tuxedoed maitre d' stood smug as a dressed-up deacon on Easter Sunday. And you might think I'm crazy, but I seen just then a movie star in a long, slinky evening gown descending the middle of that grand staircase. I do not remember her name, but I knowed I'd seen her in a movie recently. To the right, in a long salon, high arched windows were so many and so close together that they needed no electric lights to the restaurant there. Still, a long row of electric crystal chandeliers, like huge upside-down wedding cakes, lit up the place, all white and sparkling with tiers and tiers of twinkly bits of light and glass. These huge, frosted upside-down cakes, spaced one after another down the center of the whole length of that gold-trimmed ceiling, one after another into an infinity, because there were mirrors on all the walls. Another salon just like that stood to the left of where we stood, also fronting the hotel, with those high sunlit windows and a wedding cake ceiling. And there made seating for cocktails where Negro waiters was watering some swells who came to drink their lunch. Haywire parted from me, excusing himself from our company in the middle of the puffed-up speech of the hotel manager, and I stood there feeling awkward as the manager, still smiling like a funeral director, sniffed at me uncertainly. We waited, he clasping his hands, impatient and stiff, as Haywire sauntered like he just got off his horse over to a table in the restaurant where a short, plump, jowly fella sat eating by himself. Now, as Haywire got closer to him, several young men who looked like soldiers in business suits sitting at other tables nearby got up and approached, meaning to intercept him, but the short, plump man waved them off and himself stood up, grinning to see Haywire, and put out a hand to shake the one reaching for his, and they embraced. Haywire sat as he sat, and they talked together like old friends. A waiter offered to serve Haywire, but was politely refused. "He eats here every day," the manager explained proudly. I nodded. "Even on weekends," he added. "Who's that?" said I. "Mr. Hoover," he explained to me, surprised that I had not recognized him. But then I guess I did, the likeness to the G-Man in the newsreels. But I would not have if he had not said so. "Ah," I said. There seemed some tension between Mr. Hoover and Haywire when they parted. He stood, and Hoover seemed not to acknowledge it, but scowled at his plate and clenched his knife and fork and slashed at his steak. Haywire, however, seemed cheery, and the manager, following him, resumed his patter where it had been interrupted. We were escorted 12 flights up a swift private elevator to the presidential suite, the double doors to which the manager opened for us himself. The only spectacular view in Washington, I was to learn, is from the top of the Washington Monument. The suite itself, grand as it was, looked on nothing to see, but it was spectacular in itself to look at. Haywire later explained the anteroom is based upon the design of the president's Oval Office, its oval stained glass skylight designed by the same architect, and in fact, until a month ago, the suite had been occupied by President Truman himself, while the White House was renovated. "But," said Haywire, "I never found his cigarette butts in the toilet, or a ring on the coffee table after he was here, because the fucker doesn't smoke or drink. Democrats are pussies, except for Southerners," he added, bowing to his manager. The suite was enormous. It had more rooms than my house. A piano was playing in one of the rooms. With his clutch of scurrying, servile negras, the manager leapt to take lead in following the long-legged strides of Haywire, who started into the next oval room facing on the street. This one was several magnitudes larger than the oval anteroom, and off of it, all the other rooms were linked in a chain, a library this side, a sitting room that side, and several bedrooms serially with cozy private baths. I may say cozy baths, but that was because they were inward to the hotel, windowless. But in size, they were each one larger than our own living room. Suitcases were secreted to rooms. Mine went somewhere. I saw the small Negro boy take it off. Playing the grand piano, set in a raised, book-lined alcove, was Billy. Come to the hotel ahead of us, suggesting by jazz, tea for two. And Haywire took the cue, gave instructions, and the manager brusquely commanded a little high yellow negress to his side, who seemed to have been remiss for not having anticipated this wish. He scolded her in a nasty tone. She made me think of my daughter, by her slight size, the delicacy of her face. The manager confessed, "We let your valet in to precede you. I hope that I was not perhaps too presumptuous." "You may have been perhaps if I had a valet," said Haywire. "However, I think you have again shown a gentility and hospitality that is rarely found outside of Mississippi. In the solicitous deference you have shown my friend and our guest, may I introduce the Honorable Mr. William Strayhorn, Esquire." Billy, still playing playfully, nodded formally at the manager. Haywire said something to him in French. Billy replied in French. The manager looked aghast. Haywire continued, "You, sir, are a true gentleman of the old South. I do not know how I may thank you. How may I thank you?" And reached into his pocket as if to draw out a tip. The manager looked distressed and bowed to leave. He hurried his staff with sharp instructions from the suite. He was escorted to the door by Haywire, who still had his hand in his pocket, still trying to coax him to accept a tip. But the manager frowned and blushed. The manager, looking back testily at Billy, spoke something confidentially to Haywire, who shook his head at him and put his hand upon his shoulder as he backed out of the door, still speaking, and shoved him out. Haywire shut the door in his face as the manager blustered to complete a sentence. When he returned to the room, Billy swung around on the piano bench to face us, put his hands in his lap, and recited, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among them is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." While this was pronounced, Haywire bade me make whiskey and sodas from the bar enclosed in a walnut cabinet, which, when open, lit up like a fancy shop window with interior electric lights illuminating racks of crystal glassware and a wall of never-opened bottles of famous expensive brands of liquor. Then, when Billy had finished, Haywire, having strode to the piano, put a hand to his heart and the other on the shiny shellacked lid as if to address us with exalted speech. The general words above quoted would seem to embrace the whole human family, and if they were used in a similar instrument at this day, would be so understood But it is too clear for dispute that the enslaved African race were not intended to be included. The men who framed this declaration were great men. They perfectly understood the meaning of the language they used and how it would be understood by others, and they knew that it would not in any part of the civilized world be supposed to embrace the Negro race, which by common consent had been excluded from civilized governments and the family of nations and doomed to slavery. The unhappy black race is separated from the white by indelible marks. They are to be regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they have no rights which the white man is bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his benefit. He is bought and sold and treated as an ordinary article of merchandise and traffic whenever a profit could be made by it. This opinion is fixed and universal in the civilized portion of the white race. He turned to Billy and said, "Go and shine my shoes, Sambo." I brought them drinks. Billy went back to toy with tunes on the piano. The petite young negress, who had reminded me of my daughter but for her high yellow, came in pushing a lavish tea cart with French pastries under glass. Haywire insisted that she join us. She expressed fear for her employment. Haywire called the manager and asked to engage her during his visit at his discretion. It was agreed. And so she stayed and came to join our temporary household. I did not understand most of what had happened, and after I found my suitcase in a room and changed my clothes, I searched the rest of the place and found a small kitchen. And I guess because I needed something to make me feel natural, this whole thing being unreal to me, I washed the dishes we had dirtied. I knew I didn't need to, but it made me feel better. The high yellow negress, whose name was Sophie, came in and said nothing to me but watched, and seeing that I knew what I was doing and that I was not mad at her for not doing it herself, sat down at the small kitchen dinette table and asked me things. She was comfortable with me. And it was, again, as it often is for me, that though I am a white man, somehow negroes know I am one of them. She explained what had happened. She told me Washington had the segregation. She said the president didn't like it, but he couldn't stop it, and his own party wouldn't let him. The Democrats, I knowed, 'cause my papa was one, hated niggers especially, except for some like our mayor in Minneapolis, but he was almost run out because he was a nigger lover, like me, like Haywire, I guess. I asked if Haywire was going to get into trouble, and she laughed at me and said, "Mr. Mather's an owner. He can do what he please." Then she looked at the floor while I toweled off the dishes and said, "But he is a strange one. I never met no man like him." "Me neither," said I. And then she asked about me, and I told her everything, how I met you back home in the hollow where we all lived, and your mama, whom I loved like my own, because I had none, and you and our daughter and all of it. It felt good to say it. I was beginning to be able to say it without wanting to cry. Haywire had dresses brought for Sophie to choose from, and when she looked so delighted and could not choose, he told the young white sales girl to just leave them all. Sophie objected, saying she did not mean that, but Haywire said that he did. He insisted we both dress up for the party that night and be his guests with all the rest. And Billy assured us that it would be all right and that the folks coming were good folk and we should fit right in. I don't know how the time went so fast. It was just one surprising experience after another. Beef Wellington was served to us in the suite. You would not believe this dish. And then a flambé of something custard with a fortified Cointreau that I swear melted in your mouth, and one mouthful made you lightheaded. If I never again have such delights, it will not matter, because I had them once. At 10 o'clock, while Billy was trifling on the piano, all of us dressed in our best suits, Sophie in a satin indigo gown and a pearl necklace she would refuse to accept, began to find others come into the room. And Maybelle, you would not believe it. I did not believe it in my own self. I felt like it was a dream to see it. The first to arrive was Humphrey Bogart, and he brought with him that actress I seen on the staircase. She was Lauren Bacall. Sophie, knowing all the gossip from the Silver Screen magazine, explained to me quietly how Mr. Bogart was married, but his wife did not love him, and how Miss Bacall was his lover now. And I did not care if that may be wrong or not, because I liked him right off. He was just a real guy. Mr. Bogart talked to me about railroads. Many more people came. Some I'd heard of, some not. It was almost crowded. A lady writer and a friend of hers caused a stir when they came in. Everyone knew her but Sophie and me. Haywire asked how she'd been, and she said, "I've been too fucking busy," or vice versa. Then Dashiell Hammett arrived with Lillian Hellman. Him I knew. I liked his books. Her I'd heard of because of him. And that is when I learned why we were there. Mr. Hammett was going to go to jail. We were there for the send-off. And we were there because several of the other people in the room had been called to testify to Congress that last week, Mr. Bogart included, on the same matter that he was going to go to jail for, that is, whether or not he is a communist. All of this was picked up by snatches that I heard, or a question answered candidly. Only me and Sophie did not know what was going on. Everybody else understood. When I asked if Mr. Hammett was a communist and how he got to go to jail for it, Billy explained that Hammett may or may not be a communist. He didn't think Hammett would be too shy about saying so, but that the reason he was going to jail is because he helped raise money for a group that was trying to stop the lynching of Negroes, wanted a law passed by Congress. And the FBI decided that this group was a subversive organization and had outlawed it. I did not understand this. I asked, "Is it that Mr. Hoover, the one who done it?" Billy said, "Well, there you see, this has everything to do with race or riches, and little enough to do with communism." I still did not think he answered my question. Later on, someone else, the woman writer and the man who came with her, came and sat next to me on the long sofa, which was set up against the picture window overlooking the front street. I ended up talking to her a lot. She said something entirely different about the whole thing. I never was formally introduced to her, but we were speaking, and a woman with diamonds glittering all about her interrupted us and held a limp wristed, gloved hand out to her, offered like it was something she wanted her to look at carefully, and inquired with some syrup to her question, "Are you Dorothy Parker?" "Yes, I do look like me," she replied with a sweet drawl. "Wherever I go, there I am, in spite of me, or because of me. I don't know which. Where is Sart when you want him?" The man beside Mrs. Parker, her date, a quiet man in glasses, muttered softly, "You are responsible for everything except your responsibility." "Darling," she said to him, "you are my anti-hero," and flicked her cigarette ash over his cross-legged tweed trousers, and he startled at the live ember that fell onto his lap, and she, looking ashamed of herself, quickly tried to brush it off, apologizing that she really did not understand herself, and he said, helping her brush off the ash, "Understanding yourself is better left to those who know you." The lady left with a phony laugh, and the man beside Mrs. Parker muttered something French, and she laughed. "Yes, people are more fun than anybody." Mrs. Parker told Sophie and I about the appearance before Congress, how brave Mr. Bogart had been, who had nothing more criminal in him than goodwill, and had answered congressmen respectfully, who themselves possessed the courtesy of feral cats for a house mouse, were inclined to pounce and play with the corpse, having dragged Mr. Bogart into our living rooms bodily by television, and had left him to lie there limp and pitiful. Miss Bacall, sitting beside him, the scarlet letter A burning like Madonna's bleeding heart upon her chest, was inclined to jab back at the bastards, but her microphone went unexpectedly dead when she began to speak. That she chose to be there could not have been better had the event been written for a movie, and it really was a movie indeed. That's the whole of it, dramatic, political fiction entirely. She said when it was her turn to testify, she had not the courage to say what she thinks, and though people think her as predatory as a lion in a society of juicy lamb chops, she was in fact cowardly. "I was asked," Mrs. Porter told, "about Hollywood, about the secret ideology of Hollywood writers. Well, that's oxymoronic, isn't it, Hollywood and writers? So I explained to the dears that truly the only ism Hollywood believes in is plagiarism. When the prosecution rose to charge me with the evil of my associations, having been seen by some unnamed others, also evidently present, but whose unimpeachable probity should not be tarnished by disclosure, although I should be stained and sinful, I was bound to think it was because mine own probity was in doubt. Well, of course, I thought at once, they must have read my books. It was a fair return. At least I felt my own probity doubted, publicly, in the battery of flash bulbs assaulting me and raving reporters hounding me. The evil of my associations, I was led to believe, was not that I had been present merely, for my informers were present as well. But I guess I had had the bad judgment to enjoy myself, something I'm habitually guilty of doing, especially after martinis. Perhaps only after martinis. They said I was seen laughing with communists, or among them, rather than laughing at them, I should say. I explained that my humor was something I wished I had practiced with a better judgment, that it would be a good thing for them to cut on my tombstone, I said. Wherever she went, including here, it was against her better judgment. In the end, after playing with me a while, the cats let me leave, somewhat soiled, but not much visibly injured. I offered to make drinks for all and excused myself, standing up, taking in the room and the crowd of celebrities. It was like something out of Life magazine, a glamour spread on the high life. The stars come out in Washington. There was a poet and a playwright and a Philharmonic Symphony conductor, several ingenues and many rich people, a senator with a woman he said was his wife, who asked to have his photograph removed. Mr. Hammett with Miss Hellman, of course. Mr. Hammett was a tall, thin, gaunt man and looked uncomfortable as the center of attention. He looked sad. He looked like a black and white movie, but he moved slowly, thoughtfully, not like the action in his movies. He smoked a lot, and he coughed a lot, and said very little. Miss Hellman looked glossy, like Kodachrome, and talked showy, like a person who knows she's being watched. She was very big, in a small kind of way. Mr. Bogart smiled easily and was very easy in the company. He was really well-dressed, and while I expected him to have a pistol stuffed in his belt, he was so soft-spoken, polite, and gentle, and so much smaller in person than I had expected. Miss Bacall, on the other hand, was so much like she is in the movies, the same smoky voice, the same sarcastic asides, languid gestures, that I thought she was planted for a hidden camera. But she was natural, and it was the rest of us that was the actors and the props. Mrs. Parker, also a chronic smoker like Mr. Hammett, like Haywire, was the shaky kid in the class who had a smart remark under her breath for everything. And even though whapped by the ruler every time the teacher passed and wincing at it, kept up the wisecracks. Like a tick she could not shake. Her man friend I recognized then was that four-eyed sidekick, that fella Benchley, who's in them movie shorts, you see acting a smart aleck. He sat by her side with a smirk that he thought no one could see, looked like he was researching to make a short about us. Maybe because they were celebrities, they looked and acted differently. Or maybe because they looked and acted differently, they were celebrities. But then I saw how Haywire fit in with these people. They was all just larger than life. And that is a really strange thing to say. But it were just the feeling you had. They had a stage presence, even with no stage. That was the part of it. And they did not mind that stage. It was assumed to be natural. Or maybe it was just all in my head, because I had noticed that insofar as I was concerned, I could not help but feel out of place. I could not help but think that I did not belong here, and looked out of place, like a dog dressed up like a human person. Sophie, out of similar nervousness or maybe habit, kept cleaning up empty glasses and overfilled ashtrays. I helped her. Now there were speeches. Mr. Bogart began. He was very serious. Then Billy said kind words about Mr. Hammett, about the cause of lynching Negroes and the moral justice of desegregation. Then Mrs. Parker addressed them and spoke about the Speaker of the House of Representatives and their private conversation on the matter and how he sympathized with their cause. He's heaps broader-minded than a lot of these Southerners. He's really fond of colored people. Why, he says himself he won't have a white servant. Then Haywire, though in black tie, brought out his guitar from a corner where he had put it when he came in and sat at the piano bench and sang this song in Hammett's honor or so he said. Well, old Mr. Hoover had troubles all his own. He knew a commie he couldn't leave alone. Tried all he knew to put him away, put him in the pen and told him there to stay. But the commie came back the very next day, thought he was a goner, but the commie came back because he couldn't stay away. Then they tried for to switch him, to take up religion. He preached at, prayed at, got their gospel teaching. Baptized and chastised, scourged and near beat dead. But material dialectic kept a swimming in his head. Yes, the commie came back the very next day. Thought he was a goner, but the commie came back because he couldn't stay away. Well, they took him up to Congress for to make him testify. And they put to him the question, and he swore he wouldn't lie. Are you a pinko commie? You got no alibi. But rat out all your friends and we'll let it all go by. But the commie said, sir, if you don't mind, go fuck yourself. I'd rather do time, 'cause I'll never join your kind. When the song was done, I looked for and could not see Mr. Hammett. Miss Hellman was still there, though, sitting on the sofa where he had been just a moment before, and she stood up and took conversation with Haywire, thanking him warmly. No one seemed put off that Mr. Hammett was gone in the middle of his tribute. They embraced Miss Hellman like she was the real victim. Maybe she was. I don't know nothing about it. Billy sat at the piano again, and Haywire joined him in a jam. And I heard some talk about seeing them together in Paris like this. Sophie could not help herself. She picked up the glasses that people had left on the tabletops and took them to the kitchen to wash, and I helped her. On my way back to the living room, in one of the bedrooms that I passed, I heard coughing, and I seen a red faggot flare up as somebody sucked on a cigarette in the dark. And in the orb of that brief glow, a part of Mr. Hammett's face showed, where he sat alone in an armchair in the corner. He said nothing to me, and I suppose I should have left him sitting there by himself. But when my cousin went to jail, he felt bad about it. So I suppose I felt sorry for him, and I really did like his books and his movies. You know, Mr. Bogart had been in one. I asked him if maybe he'd like another drink. He said, sure. And I went and got both of us highballs of scotch. I remembered this from one of his books, that he liked scotch. When I brought it back to him, he said for me to shut the door, that the hall light was in his eyes. I did. Made my way blind in the dark, handed him the drink. He said, thanks. I sat on the edge of the bed that the armchair faced. And then he said, how do you know Raoul, or Henry, or Cisco, or whatever fucking name he goes by now? I said, Haywire. He thought, he sucked on his cigarette. He blew out the smoke. That fits, said he. He squashed out the stub of his cigarette, sipped his drink, lit a fresh cigarette. I told him how I met him. As I watched him doing these things, he said nothing about what I said. After some silence, I turned his question back onto him.